Is UFO disclosure right around the corner? And we've had a recent rise in UFO sightings, as Peter Davenport has reported on this program as well. And then, of course, we have the Aztec incident, recovery at Hart Canyon. Up next, the father of modern-day ufology joins us, Stanton Friedman, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we've gone way up to the east to wake him up, Stanton Friedman, father of modern-day ufology. Stan, how are you?
Tired, of course, at this ridiculous hour, George.
You love it. You thrive on this, Stan.
Well, yeah, but let's remember, it is 4 in the morning in beautiful Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, where I live.
By the way, you did a spectacular job when we went up to Toronto a few months ago. Just fantastic.
Thank you. I enjoyed that. It was quite an event. I was delighted.
The people there are something else, aren't they?
They certainly are, and I've commented to others about that, Canadians are nice people, and these people were joyful, and they weren't even drinking.
At least not during the event.
Not during the event. And what surprised me the most, George, frankly, was not only how attentive they were while we were on stage and stuff, but the fact that some of them stood around for 2 hours waiting to get our autographs on the program.
That was amazing. I mean, that line just went around the building, and they were there, and you were there signing autographed copies of your book. And they were gobbling it up.
Yeah. It was. I was pleased too because it's been a while since I spent any time in downtown Toronto, and there are an awful lot of people who had seen me or heard me at lectures I had given at colleges and other places in Canada, and I don't often get a chance to hear those comments. So it was a good thing all around. And you know, I didn't know when we started. So how many people are going to come out? Willing to pay money to listen to us and stuff like that. And great facility. Things went extremely well. I was delighted.
What did you think of your buddy's singing abilities?
I'm not a critic of music. I was at my table signing books, as a matter of fact.
That's right. Quickly. Anyways, I'm glad things are going well with you. You feeling well? Life good?
Life is good. I mean, I'm getting older, but it's better than the alternative, you know.
I mean, I love telling this story. When I was 21, you were my first radio interview back in Detroit. Can you believe that? We're talking 1971, Stan. My God.
Yeah, I can believe it.
42 years ago.
A lot of water has gone over the dam, as they say. But, who would have thought that both of us would be still
doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
We haven't changed. You were doing your UFO stuff then, and I was doing my radio stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, somebody asked me the other day a bunch of questions for a long interview, and how is it that a nuclear physicist becomes a full-time ufologist? And, you know, it's not because I decided, that's what I want to do. The heck with this working in industry and all this. I enjoyed my work in industry. I didn't like canceled programs. But there was a crucial event. This is crazy. I don't think I've told this on the air before. I was driving across the country to take what would be the ideal job for me at McDonnell Douglas Astronautics in Santa Monica, California, working for Dr. Bob Wood. And my job was going to be to try to figure out the technology of flying saucers. Who could ask for anything more? Well, as it happens, as I'm halfway across the country from Pittsburgh, where I'd work on Westinghouse's nuclear rockets, fission nuclear rockets, and we had a great success. The system ran. Everything worked. I was very pleased.
Did
I got laid off. But halfway across the country, I got heard on the radio that the program that was funding my work had been canceled, and they laid off 5,000 people.
Oh, my God. Well, now, this kind of technology, were you looking at reversed engineered technology here?
No, I was trying to figure out, how to reverse it, but I didn't have a piece of a saucer. I did not have any inside information along those lines.
Okay.
But I had done a lot of looking at the far-out technology. In my congressional testimony in 1968, I had talked about magneto-aerodynamics and things like that. So it was one of those things that when that job got canceled, that wonderful job that I was going to really enjoy, I got another short-term job, but my idea was I got to control my own destiny. you know, I got a family, got kids to feed, mortgage, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it was no turning back from that point on. And what pleased me, of course, was, and what got me truly thinking it might be okay to devote my life to such a crazy thing, was the enthusiastic response of my professional colleagues. I spoke to engineering groups. I spoke to the American
Nuclear Society. When you were in Detroit, when we met, and I met you at Oakland University, one of the colleges, but you had already addressed that day the Engineering Society of Detroit, I think.
Well, probably the day before.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're enthusiastic. They were sold out for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk 3 weeks in advance. And that surprised me, frankly. Who knew? And then the nuclear groups, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. I mention this, George, because a lot of people think, oh, who was interested in UFOs besides a bunch of kooky, quacky people, you know? Well, it was the professional people. It was their response.
That's right.
And that, you know, I keep close to my heart. I enjoy the response. How can I not respect the response of engineers, people like the Engineering Society of Detroit? These aren't kooks and quacks walking down the street with nothing better to do. They're professional people. And I say this to encourage people to talk about their sightings, to read, not only to read the books and all that sort of stuff, but it's okay. I mean, when I checked my audiences, George, I found 10% of the people believe they've seen a flying saucer, but 90% of those people didn't report what they saw.
That's right.
And that's the kicker. And the more respectable the individual, the less likely he is to report it, you know.
Well, when you started this, Stan, when you really got into it, I mean, we had people in the field, Frank Edwards, a great journalist, Edward Ruppelt. We had, you know, we had NICAP, you know.
NABRO, yeah.
Yeah, we had great organizations. I mean, they took this seriously then.
Oh, yes.
And today, other than a few solid researchers, including yourself, there aren't a lot of people out there anymore pushing this. How come?
Well, I think there's a kind of general level of acceptance of something that wasn't the case back in 71, and that is of the whole question about life in the universe and, you know, the Kepler satellite with its wonderful results of planets all over the darn place out there, and a much better understanding. There aren't too many people now who think the universe was created in 4004 B.C., October 26th, I think it was. There's a much greater recognition of how huge, how old, how exciting. And kids don't grow up with the notion of, oh, that's nuts to think about life in outer space. It's accepted. And there's been a transition, in other words. Well, a German scientist once said, new ideas come to be accepted, not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to
them. That's true.
This is quite different.
Good point.
So I think a higher percentage of people are reporting their sightings, they're willing to listen, and the old fogies are dying. Oh, you're still going to have your pockets of silliness and ancient academics and fossilized physicists who say, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. This can't possibly be real because if it was true, I would know about it, and I don't, so it must not be. You know, that attitudes have changed, and I think that's why Peter is getting more reports.
That's right.
If you only get 10% of the observations being reported, and then you say you double that, that makes a big difference. And MUFON's been getting over 600 reports a month. You know, that's a lot of people. And I think the media people are gradually outgrowing their automatic, that's a bunch of nonsense kind of stuff. There's still garbage on the internet that I find from time to time. Somebody just explained Roswell as a huge polyethylene balloon. And if you go back and check the records, there weren't any at the time of Roswell. The first big polyethylene balloon, and they were big, was in September of 1947. What do you have, time travel for polyethylene balloons to go back to July? I mean, that's absurd. And this guy enunciated very clearly that that's all we're dealing with here, folks, is bad memories and stuff that's, quote, standard technology. And, you know, I'd love to take these guys on. You and I have been involved in two debates on the air, Dr. Seth Shostak and Dr. Michael Shermer. Yeah,
and you slaughtered both of them.
Yeah, it went pretty well. Also, I won one at the Oxford University Debating Society.
Ah.
How much more legitimate can you get than that? And the kicker, the obvious reason is that my opponents didn't know anything about the subject. They thought they could get away with research by proclamation. There is no evidence, meaning I'm too lazy to look at the evidence, you know.
Huh.
So I've been very pleased that during my lifetime there's been such a change in attitude and acceptance. And, you know, I've only had 11 hecklers, and two of them were drunk, and that's well over 700 lectures.
That's not bad.
No, you're going to get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics, you know, you name it. And the audience took care of everybody. I mean, two of the 11 were drunk, so I didn't have to worry about that.
So true. Well, but, you know, back in 1971, I had also interviewed by phone Dr. Benjamin Simon, who was the psychiatrist, as you know, for Barney and Betty Hill, that incredible Interrupted journey.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, we are going to commemorate, celebrate, whatever the right word is, his work. The 50th anniversary was last year of the Betty and Barney Hill case, and there was a conference at IndianHeadResort.com. You can go to that website, and you'll see about it. Kathleen Martin was the hostess for the conference. She's Betty's niece, has all the hypnosis tapes and all that sort of thing. And we're going to be there again on the 14th and 15th. Of September, and people can go to www.IndianHeadResort.com to get the program for the meeting. She'll lecture, I'll lecture. We're going to show the movie, the television movie, The UFO Incident, James Earl Jones, way back in 1970.
Oh, yeah, great movie.
And I think it's still an irony of the times that I was asked to be a consultant on that film, which I was, and they got my name, Universal Studios got my name for the United States Air Force because I was living in Southern California. And, you know, I didn't expect them to be recommending me for anything, but they're supposed to tell people who come to ask them questions, talk to a scientist in the neighborhood, don't bother us. So I invite everybody to come on down. It's beautiful in September in New Hampshire. The leaves are out and all that sort of stuff. And they'll have, go to the website, they'll see it. And we will have a bus tour of the sites where things happened, where they were abducted, where the craft landed, where we came close to the car just above it. They can see it all right there with Kathleen and myself. And I was co-author on the book, Captured, the Betty and Barney.
That's right.
UFO
That's
experience.
Exciting.
And well, so... You know, I'm looking forward to that because I remember last year how good it was. Do you know that the state of New Hampshire dedicated a big sign on the road there to that event? And Kathy had to go through all kinds of hoops answering all kinds of questions to make sure this was not a kooky thing. And then the Indian Head Resort also dedicated a big sign. And they can have their pictures taken with Kathy and me, too, if they want. The 14th and the 15th. So that's one event. And, you know, talking about anniversaries, September 12th, coming up, is the 60th anniversary of the Flatwoods monster case.
That's right.
Flatwoods
Frank Frischino's, right?
Yeah, and his new book, The Braxton County Monster, the publisher had fouled up royally the first time around. Frank got back control of the book.
Good. I know he was telling us.
It'll be out. Yeah, he had a lot of troubles with that, you know, legal stuff and all that. But he spent 20 years on that case. I've been up there. We've had a couple of conferences there, and I talked to some of the key witnesses who are no longer with us. Excellent case. And, you know, it does provide a couple of ludicrous examples of debunkery. Dr. Joe Nickel... English degrees, not science degrees. He explained that case as a 6-foot owl, the monster. That's what it was. He didn't even go to the site where the owl was seen, see the tree under which it had moved and was seen by other witnesses and all that sort of stuff. A 6-foot owl Anybody out there got any 6 foot owls?
Yeah,
I'd sure like
whatever it was, it was huge. Stan, you know, I want to talk with you a little bit about a book you wrote the foreword to, The Aztec Incident.
Yeah, I'm very pleased about that because originally, and this happened March of 1948, not very long.
All right, right after Roswell, yeah.
Yeah, and Aztec, for those who don't know, is in the northwest corner of New Mexico, right at the Four Corners area there, where four states come together in one point. And it had been thought to be a hoax. Frank Scully wrote a book. He worked for a Variety, you know, not a serious researcher, it says here. And it's very controversial, but everybody figured it was a hoax. And then Scott and Suzanne Ramsey got involved, and they thought they'd be able to answer whether it was a hoax or not pretty darn quick, and that was over 20 years ago. The book finally came out, and I wrote the foreword and the comments in it, and I was so pleased with the work that they've done. I've been to the Aztec. There was a conference there several years. But they really spent a ton of money and effort. Suzanne is from up around there. They had family there. And they dug out witnesses nobody else had talked to. And one of the key things, and I got a kick out of this, Scott found a guy who was an expert at moving huge pieces of equipment, power plant components, you know, generators and things like that. And it's kind of a difficult art to move them from point A, where they're manufactured, to point B, where they're put in place, because we've got bridges and rivers and tunnels and all those things, and big stuff won't fit. And everybody said there was no way that you could get anything from up in the Aztec area there, Hart Canyon Road, over to Los Alamos, which is northern New Mexico, and which is where it supposedly went. Well, Scott hired this guy to look at the maps of the time. They went over the whole route, look at the equipment that was available at the time. And this guy, who was not a UFO believer, discovered to his surprise that, yes, the story was that the object, maybe 90-plus feet in diameter,
it's huge for at that point, yeah.
Yeah, and it hadn't, it crashed, might be the wrong word. It made a difficult landing, let's put it that way. It had supposedly had been divided into three parts, like all Gaul, and moved over to Los Alamos. And this expert found that with the roads the way they were, the bridges the way they were, the equipment that was available, it was definitely plausible to do that at that time. This is not from a UFO believer, but a guy whose job it was to move large things around. And that's an art, as anybody who has looked into that at all will know. It works. And also they found the papers of Frank Scully. Nobody else had looked at those. They were out west. And so I'm excited by the book. It just came out a couple months ago. It's listed on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. They can go to Aztec, I'm sure, find loads of references on the internet. But it's a good book, and I have some copies that are signed by them, and both of them, and by myself. So, and somebody wrote me back, gee, I didn't know I was going to get signatures in there from all of you guys. Well, that's what you do. You know, it doesn't cost you much to write your name, sign your name, but a lot of people want that sort of stuff.
Stan, let me ask you this. You know, we've had these incidents, Roswell, the Aztec incident, even incidents that probably went back even further than that. What do you think is going on?
Well, I guess the simplest way is to give my conclusions since 1958, when I read the first book. What's that, 54 years?
Hold on right there, Stan. The hour came up really fast on us. We'll be right back. Well, you're into UFOs. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines and take a few questions with Stanton Friedman as well. Hey, have you been to the new Coast store? You can be. Go to coasttocoastam.com and look at all the new items they've got. You'll have some fun doing it. Not too early to start shopping for the holidays. And welcome back with Stanton Friedman. Stan, we were talking about what you think has been going on all these years.
Or millennia. It's been. Well, four basic conclusions. One, the evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. That doesn't mean all UFOs are alien spacecraft. That means some are. Not all isotopes are fissionable either. Not all people are 7 feet tall. It's the ones that are that matter, if you're the basketball coach, for example. That's the first thing. The second thing is we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate. In other words, I worked under security for 14 years. You don't keep secrets by telling everybody and hoping nobody opens their mouth. You restrict access to the information on a need-to-know basis. And there are some few people, in other words, in government who know what's going on. And, there, of course, there are some people who figure if there was anything going on, they would know about it. And they don't, so there must be nothing. You know, the old ego gets into the picture. And there are a lot of people around Washington who think nothing important happens without them knowing about it. Well, they're wrong. In my book, Flying Saucers and Science, there's a whole chapter about the Cosmic Watergate and examples of multi-billion-dollar programs that were kept secret for a long time. You can keep secrets. The third conclusion is there are no good arguments against the first two. I would get all kinds of people saying it's all nonsense. That's easy to say, not easy to demonstrate because it isn't true. And I listened to their arguments, like when I was debating with Seth or Michael Shermer on your program, and they don't have good arguments. Ignorance, in other words, saying there is no evidence is not a good way to demonstrate that there's nothing to it. That's research by proclamation. And the fourth conclusion is that we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium. Visits to planet Earth by alien spacecraft, successful cover-up of the best data, bodies, and wreckage for all these years, 65 since Roswell. Pretty straightforward. And the kicker here is there's one point that keeps recurring. I just read the English, somebody in England, these new papers released on, by the Ministry of Defense. Well, why would anybody go to an unimportant planet in an unimportant solar system? And they seem to ignore reality. Let me give the biggest reason.
Sure.
I presume every advanced civilization is concerned about its own survival and security. If they weren't so concerned, they wouldn't survive, you know. And that means you got to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close tabs on those primitives will show signs of being able to bother you. You want to make a mess at your planet, that's one thing. You want to make a mess on my planet, that's something else. And so there were three signs way back at the end of World War II that soon these idiot Earthlings, people raise an eyebrow when I say that, but look, we killed 60 million people in World War II, we Earthlings. We destroyed 1,700 cities. We're not nice guys. Soon these guys would be moving out, soon meaning less than 100 years, which is nothing on a cosmic time scale. And the three signs were nuclear weapons, the genie was out of the bottle, in other words, powerful rockets being used for destruction, the German V-2s and their successors. And the third was radar as an indication of the electronics revolution. People forget there was no radar before World War II started in Europe. There was only one place in the world where you could study all three of those, southeastern New Mexico, first nuclear weapon Trinity site. I've been there. I'm possibly leading another tour of the area in October. It's on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, as an event. And it's also where we were firing to capture German V-2s and where we had our best radar because some of the rockets went south instead of north. Not a good thing to do. The Mexicans weren't very happy about that. Now, here's the kicker. We made a leap, an extraordinary leap in our control of technology able to get us to the stars. We figured out fusion was the way the stars work in about 1938, nuclear fusion. Every advanced civilization is going to do that. They want to know where's the energy coming from in that big ball of gas down the street there. We figured it out in 38. In 44, a big bomb was a 10-ton blockbuster. 10 tons of TNT, that's how much energy you release. Made a big hole in the ground, too. We dropped a lot of those. But everything changed. In 1945, Trinity site, New Mexico, first A-bomb, about 19,000 tons of TNT worth of energy release. Well, in 1952, 7 years after that, we set off our first H-bomb.
And that started some things, didn't it?
Yeah, 10 million tons of TNT. Can you imagine from 10 to 19,000 to 10 million? The Russians outdid us with one that was 57 million tons of TNT equivalent. You've had Robert Hastings on the show.
Mm-hmm, sure have.
Talking about his work with nukes and UFOs. Now, anybody with any sense knows that you can use nuclear energy for propulsion. The Navy, for example, had nuclear submarine as early as 1956. Can go around the world underwater instead of just spending a day underwater, as right. The old submarines did. We have aircraft carriers that can operate for 18 years without refueling. That's incredible.
It is.
I've worked on studies of nuclear fusion propulsion way back in 1962, would you believe? It'll be expensive, sure. Atom bombs were expensive. We built them. Involved a lot of people. But we did it, and several other countries have done it. So what I'm saying is, any sensible alien would look at us and say, A, they're nasty people. They're spending $1 trillion this year on things military when there are all kinds of people starving and being killed in crazy warfare of some sort or other.
And they've never stopped fighting.
No. The 60 million was just World War II. So what I'm saying is, of course, anybody with any brains is going to want to check out this place and make sure we don't export our brand of friendship. Everybody else calls it hostility, of course, but we're nice guys, aren't we? So, you know, the notion that nobody would want to come here is really ridiculous. I admit, now, one astronomer came up with a reason for coming here. They would be able to tell that our CO2 level has gone up some, so global warming may be doing these people in, you know, like CO2 was a pollutant. It isn't. Every living plant on the planet needs CO2, you know. So what I'm trying to say is, when we look at this realistically, we're dealing with something of great importance. As you correctly stated, the Vatican has not said this is all nonsense. There's certain fundamentalists, Pat Robertson, who have said the only intelligent life in the universe is on planet Earth. I'm not sure we've demonstrated there is intelligent life on the planet Earth, you know, with how we act. I'm worried about my great-grandson, George. I've got one. What kind of world is he going to grow up in? More nuclear weapons?
Probably.
No, I hope not. And I think one of the other big things we're looking at here is governments don't want to give up power. You may have noticed that over the years. Nobody in power wants to give it up. So another reason for keeping the secret is to stay in power. Let the next generation worry about the reality of what's happening on the planet. So I'm intrigued by the fact that within my lifetime, we've gone from thinking, this is the only planet in the universe. We're the only civilization in the universe. Dear old Kepler, I love that satellite. Incredible piece of work, incidentally. And I should clear up a point. I've been asked several times, why doesn't Kepler look at Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, the two stars from the Betty and Barney Hill star map? It can't. Those are southern sky. That's a southern sky constellation. And it can only look at an area of space about the size of your fist at arm's length. It goes out and comes back and measures again and again and again. You know, it can sort of like finding a butterfly flying in front of a car headlight a few miles away. That's sensitive. You know? So we do what we can, but let's not ask the impossible this week anyway. So I'm excited about flying saucers. I'm excited about not the cover-up as such, but the fact that people are beginning to emerge and recognize what's going on. And, you know, I am impressed with the fact that one of the great events of the last 65 years is that we haven't used those thousands of nuclear weapons.
That's right.
That have been exploded. I mean, everybody thought we would have. I can remember, you know, all the precautions, duck under the desk.
It's total destruction if somebody does.
Yeah, you realize, and a lot of people don't. I was surprised at this. I thought everybody was aware. We have exploded 2,000 of their weapons, George.
Yeah.
Only two on people.
40. Two on people, the rest tests. Huh?
Yeah, and some of them underground. But that those nuclear weapons are sitting around out there, and a lot of them are. One of the good programs was a joint effort from the United States and Russia to get rid of nuclear weapons, to disarm them, if you will, put the fissionable material back into nuclear reactors, power systems, et cetera, et cetera. So, but it's an exciting world we live in. We need the textbooks to start recognizing that we are not alone, and that has implications. And wouldn't it be nice if an announcement were to be made by my favorite couple, the Queen and the Pope? You know, they're about the same age.
You know what? The Vatican may have leaked something a few years ago, though. Remember when they said?
Oh, I remember. All right. My first thought after the Vatican astronomer said, you know, there's nothing wrong with the idea of
believing
brothers in outer space and stuff like that. And then the Pope echoed that. My first thought was, what does he know that we don't? You know, I don't have any inside to the Pope, obviously, but. It was nice to hear what he said, because unlike Pat Robertson, he has allowed for the possibility of there being life out there. And, you know, you can have discussions about did Jesus die to save them, and these are all off to the side. The question is, did he say there wasn't anybody out there? No, he did not.
He never
allowed
did.
For it. And that's a big move in the right direction as far as I'm concerned.
Stan, when they apparently shut down our missile silos, why didn't they finish the job and just let the world know, hey, we can do this at any time?
Well, you know, the motivation of aliens is a difficult subject, and they seem to be focused on, there seem to be limits as to what they're willing to do. In other words, you could wipe the whole place out. That would be the easiest thing, to get rid of the idiots. But that doesn't seem to be the way the neighborhood works. And I presume that any organization, whether it's the Galactic Federation or some equivalent thereof, has rules of behavior. And I think it seems clear that one of the rules says you don't just go willy-nilly, splat, splat, and get rid of the bad guys, because that'll make them angry. And then you got a war in your hands, and we don't want to be destroying civilizations. So my only thought is that they must hope that we will straighten up and fly right at some point in time. And like I say, the fact that we haven't exploded nuclear weapons on people, considering all there were around, is a good sign. So someday, probably after I'm long gone, we will find out what was going through the heads of our guys and of the aliens. And, you know, I'm waiting. Art Campbell is a guy who is coming out with a book about, how shall I put it, Ike's meetings with aliens.
Well, we've all heard those rumors, haven't we, about that?
Yeah, we have. And I think it may very well have happened, and Ike would have been the right guy. Can you imagine how difficult it must have been? What was his job after the war? To get Germany to join France, America, and Britain to stand off the Russians. Now, France, America, and Britain had just fought a terrible war with the Germans. And now we're supposed to be friends. And Ike managed to do that. He was well-respected. He knew how to be diplomatic. He was forged in, you know, in the war and how to get things done. And so it wouldn't surprise me, and Art is looking at a lot of evidence, for people who are wondering, what the heck is he talking about? He's found crew members of the president's airplane and secret trips to when Ike was supposedly playing golf in Georgia and when he was supposedly playing golf in California, where apparently he was at Holloman Air Force Base meeting with aliens. Now, I can't guarantee you that, but the evidence is looking stronger and stronger. And so it wouldn't surprise me. Now, I wish I had a crystal ball, George, you know, 30 years from now, what are things going to be like on this planet? We know there'll be new technology, but will we have some new sociology to start living at peace with each other? That's what I worry about.
Well, that's a good question, Stan. Are people still seeing these large triangular-shaped objects?
I don't know. I haven't looked at the latest list from MUFON, or I don't know what Davenport is saying they're seeing. They're certainly still having sightings.
There's lots of sightings all over the place.
Yeah, and, you know, it's hard to keep tabs on all this stuff. You can get the MUFON Journal, and you'll find out about reports. And his website has stuff. And I just wish that we had a better television system that would tell us more good stuff, factual stuff. You've heard the objections about the National Geographic programs.
Sure.
And it's a shame, because I think management doesn't realize what the heck's been going on and isn't taking it seriously enough. There's more than entertainment value, George.
Right. But I don't see disclosure coming from government, Stan. Do you?
Well, I could
be whistleblowers.
I don't see any signs of that happening. And you know, what I want is a Woodward Bernstein, you know, to disclose. And maybe my movies.
Well, we've got you and Dolan to do that.
Well, yeah. And look, two of my books have been optioned for movies. Top Secret Magic about the Majestic 12 stuff, mm-hmm. with Don Schmidt's book, Visitors to Roswell. And the book that we were talking about earlier, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Now, I hate to admit this, but more people watch movies than read books, George.
That's true.
And so, you know, maybe these will have an impact if they get made, and it's a crapshoot when you're talking about Hollywood and what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. The screenplay for Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C, has already been rewritten 3 times. Now, maybe they'll get it right, and somebody will come forward, and that will start things rolling. I don't know.
Are you finding that your requests for your speaking engagements are still strong than they have been over the years?
Well, I'm finding that I'm getting requests, and without my having to do much about it. I used to do mailings to 1,000 colleges at a time, George. A lot of work.
Oh, yeah. You used to push yourself.
Yeah, and I haven't been. I've been sitting back, and the requests come to me. So, I mean, I'm an old guy, George. I'm even older than you are, you know.
You're the father of ufology, you know?
Or grandfather or great-grandfather or something like that. But, I find that people want to hear what I have to say, that there are conferences going on sort of all over the place. The Roswell event was very well attended this year in early July, and I've already committed to be at next year's.
Good for you.
And so
you were the Grand Marshal at one of the parades, weren't you, a few years ago?
Yeah, and I've stood in the back of a number of convertibles and waved the kids along the way in the parade, and it's fun. And, you know, I get a kick out of people complaining about this stuff for kids to do down there in Roswell. Well, of course. Look, Roswell is 200 miles from Amarillo, from Albuquerque, from El Paso. Parents going out of their way. They got to have some for their kids.
Exactly. Stan, stay with us. We've got a final hour to go. We're going to come back in just a moment and take phone calls. Lots of people interested in talking with you. Stanton Friedman, our guest, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.